Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Walter Isaacson, whose new book is Leonardo da Vinci. Walter Isaacson has built an impressive career as a journalist, chairman of CNN, editor of Time magazine. As a public figure, he will end a 14-year tenure as CEO of the Aspen Institute at the end of 2017, and as a best-selling author of biographies of Benjamin Franklin, Albert Einstein, and Steve Jobs. Next year, he plans to begin a new life back in New Orleans part-time as a university professor of history at Tulane University. Today, we're talking about his wonderful new book, Leonardo da Vinci, the most recent in a long line of studies of genius. Walter Isaacson, I'm so happy to welcome you back to The Reading Life.
Oh, it's great to be back with you, Susan.
Now, I've been reading your books for a very long time, as you know, and it seems to me that this is an instance of a subject appearing when the writer is ready. This book seems to me to draw upon all your strengths. Did you feel that way as you were writing it?
Well, exactly true, and you and I do go way back. And as you've looked at the things we've been interested in, it's been smart people, creative people, innovative people. And I kind of learned that smart people are a dime a dozen. What makes genius is creativity and imagination. And so when I did Ben Franklin, I realized his genius came from looking across different disciplines, from being interested about everything from art to science. And that was true of Steve Jobs as well. And for me, the ultimate person in that category was Leonardo da Vinci. Whether it's in his notebooks or in the things he did, he was curious about everything there was to know about everything that could be known.
I know that you thought about some other subjects too, but what was it that finally inclined your heart toward him?
When I saw Leonardo's notebooks, I mean, most people have written about Leonardo or art critics, and so they base it on the, 12 or so great painting masterpieces. But when I started running across and then searching out the notebooks that Leonardo left behind, I realized there was more than 7,000 pages, some of them in Florence and Milan or Paris or Madrid or Windsor Castle, and even in Bill Gates' home in Seattle. And I realized that I could see a mind that was dancing with nature, that was dancing with imagination, as I just turned page after page of his notebooks. And so that's what convinced me to write the book. And the book is based partly on just looking at his notebooks.
And I love that this kind of reinvigorated your love of paper as a technology.
When I was doing Steve Jobs, we were trying to find his emails from the 1990s when he worked at Next Computer. And even with all of his techies, he couldn't retrieve some of the emails from his Next Computer operating system. But 500 years after Leonardo died, we're still able to look at the paper that he wrote on. So it reminded me, paper is a really good technology. It's good for the storage and retrieval of information.
And I love the way he used so much of the page, because paper was valuable.
Paper was slightly expensive, especially for somebody like him. So he crams everything he possibly can on each page of paper. It goes back and finds a little corner where he can do something. So you watch his mind wander. There's a notebook page I describe in the book, and I reprint in the book, in which he does his doodle of the craggy old warrior. But coming out of the guy's back is sort of mountains, because he's got him against mountains. But then he's drawing triangles, and how triangles and circles, how you can make them have the same area. And then he's drawing clouds, and then swirls of water, and then, a young boy, and then some mathematical drawings. And you see his mind making step-by-step leaps with maybe not with reason, but with rhyme. You know, with rhyme but not reason, we see his mind dashing across that notebook page.
You know, he's such a well-rounded character. His intellect is free-ranging, and he's such an autodidact. You talk a lot about how he kind of dodged a bullet by not going to school.
He had the great fortune to be born out of wedlock, which means that he could not be a notary or lawyer like his father was, and grandfather and great-grandfather. And also, he can't go to university because, you know, he was illegitimate and so didn't qualify for the university. So he has to teach himself through observation and pure curiosity. And this is the beginning of the Renaissance and even the beginning of the scientific method, which is instead of received wisdom you're getting from the books at the university, you test it out. Somebody says, here's the way water flows, or here's the way fossils got to the top of mountains. And you say, well, let me do an experiment. Let me go look for myself. And so we see the beginning of the scientific method in Leonardo's willing to question received wisdom.
And I love that he was a painter who really wanted to be regarded as an engineer. I mean,
you know, when he reached that unnerving milestone, which you and I vaguely remember, of turning 30 years old, you know, he writes a job application letter to the Duke of Milan. It's 11 paragraphs. And the first 10 paragraphs talk about his engineering skills and how he can make weapons and how he can divert rivers and how he can build buildings. And only in the 11th paragraph does he say, I can also paint and sculpt as well as any person. And, yeah, there he does. He goes to Milan and paints the Last Supper for the Duke. So, yes, between the Last Supper and then the Mona Lisa, he's painted the two greatest paintings in history. But he thought of himself as an engineer, and also he would not have made a distinction between the curiosity he had about engineering and the curiosity that he had about art.
Well, his art took so many forms. You know, I love his background in theatrical pageants, which we go into a bit. And it made me wonder what Leonardo would come up with for a Mardi Gras parade. You know, I think
you would actually know. In fact, some of the pictures in my book are from his notebook pages of what masquerades, pageants, and parades. And there's a wonderful guy in a costume that looks like it could be on the float of Bacchus or Rex, you know, looking like a little young warrior with tunics and clown's hats and everything else. And that was his main job during the time of his 20s and 30s, was producing parades and pageants in Florence and then Milan, because they didn't have TV back then or movies. And that's the way they were amused. And that is so key to his imaginative art, because he fantasizes about winged, you know, helicopters that could be part of pageants. And then he ends up engineering flying machines. Or he imagines the accelerated perspective you'd use if you were putting a table with people around it on a stage. And then that same magic he uses when he paints The Last Supper.
Well, I think you were uniquely positioned to appreciate the pageants. I really do.
The Mardi Gras background sure helped me. People say, you know, almost every piece of writing about Leonardo said he wasted his time some doing plays and pageants. I'm going, no, no, no. That's key to him. Just like a key to loving Mardi Gras might be a key to understanding the music as well as the creativity of New Orleans.
Right. Now, you've looked so closely and so long at his great paintings, The Last Supper, The Mona Lisa, as you kind of build up to those in the course of the book. And I wonder, did you feel yourself, as you wrote, growing in skill at analyzing this art?
I had all sorts of wonderful teachers who helped me, whether it's Martin Kemp at Oxford or Vincent Deluvian at the Louvre. And I'd look at St. Anne, for example, one of his paintings in the Louvre that's near the Mona Lisa in the Louvre. And I'd say, okay, it doesn't quite move me because I don't feel the emotion in the eyes of St. Anne and the Madonna. You know, but then I'd look at Lady with an Ermine, which was not very famous painting Leonardo did. And both the ermine, you know, the mm-hmm. animal she's holding, and the lady, both are reacting, and you can see the emotion in their eyes. So I think, you know, it's like whether you're trying to learn physics or trying to learn what an artist does, you just throw yourself into it the way Leonardo would have us do, because Leonardo felt he could learn anything as long as he was curious and observant enough.
But you did such a great job with the science of it, with the development, you know, his ideas of optics, his ideas about perspective. You analyze all that, and then you bring into the foreground contemporary technology that's made it possible for us to know so much more.
This is the great thing about writing about Leonardo today, is there's so much to discover and so much more to apply to our lives today, which is understanding, for example, you know, how our new technologies can look at each brushstroke he put on the Mona Lisa, or how we know he dissected the human eye to show that the center part of the retina sees details and the edges of the retina see shadows, and that's how he made the Mona Lisa's smile flicker on and off. Because if you're looking directly at it, the detail makes it look like she's not smiling much, but if your eye wanders to her cheek or to her chin, the sort of edge of seeing her smile, the shadows make it look like she's smiling more broadly. So that smile flickers, but it helps to understand both the science, the optics, the anatomy, as well as the brushstrokes. And that's the lesson of Leonardo today for our kids and for ourselves, is don't say we only need to know engineering or coding or science, or that if we're a humanist or love art, to say, well, I'll ignore science. You gotta love the connection between all of the humanities and all of the sciences.
Well, one of the things that you do seem to love about him so much is his sense of mystery, the way lines are blurred in his paintings, the way there's a little mystery to his life, and his personal style as well.
You know, that's probably the final lesson in my book, which is embrace mystery. I say that if you're going to be like Leonardo, you have to be curious. You have to be observant. There are many other things you have to do. You have to not categorize things into silos or disciplines. But in the end, the big lesson is embrace mystery. Because his great contribution to art and to science was what he called sfumato, which is the lines that aren't very sharp, but they're kind of blurry, as if it were smoke dissipating into the air. And he said, just like he did his fantasies and his pageants and his plays, as well as his scientific drawings of dissections or of flying machines, he said, the really interesting thing is that blurred line between observation and imagination.
Now, he seems to have been a skilled politician as well, at a time when politics was difficult and intricate. I mean, the Borgias, the Medici, the Sforza family, Machiavelli is one of his acquaintances, and yet he survived.
Yeah, it was a time almost as complicated as the current time, when you have, you know, Caesar Borgia and the Duke of Milan and Machiavelli advising them, etc. Leonardo was a very kindly, sweet person. And yet for 1 year, he does go to work for Caesar Borgia, who's a pretty tough warlord. And he's a partner with Machiavelli, working with Borgia. They're all in the tiny town of Imola, Italy, for months on end as they're planning military campaigns. But I think Leonardo, it just doesn't really suit him to play politics or to be engaged in brutal battle. And so in less than a year, he kind of leaves and ends up back in Milan, painting the most peaceful of all paintings, you know, The Virgin and the Rocks.
Machiavelli should have written The Artist Engineer instead of The Prince.
Machiavelli worshipped at the feet of Caesar Borgia. And we have a wonderful book out of that called The Prince. I do wish he had written more about Leonardo, too, because it's not just power, but power connected to a sense of humanity that makes politics beneficial. And that's what Leonardo came to learn.
Now, one thing I particularly love about this book is its sheer physical beauty. I mean, you've taken such great care with these illustrations.
You know, I give Simon & Schuster, the publisher, so much credit because they used a really high quality paper, you know, very white paper with a shine, so that when you reproduce the Mona Lisa or the Last Supper or his notebook pages, they're gorgeous. And I think there's about 150 illustrations and paintings in the book. And, of course, it's not a textbook. It reads like a fast-paced narrative. But you also, as you're reading, every page is in color. So if I say something like, look at the way he draws water flowing into a pond, and then the ripples against the ankles in the baptism of Christ, you know, right there on the page next to you is this unbelievable piece of art by Leonardo. So I'm very lucky. I've gotten to the stage in my career where I can convince the publisher to use really high-quality paper, but still not make it an expensive book.
Well, it is exquisite. It really is. Now, to me, this seems in many ways your most personal book. I love the way you disagree with perceived wisdom, the way you argue with accepted interpretations, you make comparisons to your own earlier work, and you make your own attempts to be like Leonardo.
That's the lesson of the book. You and I and our children and our nieces and nephews are never going to be like Einstein. We're never going to be like Einstein. Einstein was touched by the heavens with a superhuman processing power you and I are never going to understand. But we can all be like Leonardo. And even more importantly, we can instill in our children that sense of curiosity, observation, willingness to indulge fantasy and mystery, and a belief that you should love both art and engineering. Those are the types of things we can do on our own. For example, Leonardo made a list every few days of what he wanted to learn, and the lists are in his notebook, and they're fascinating. Weird things like, how do they walk on ice in Holland? What does the tongue of a woodpecker look like? Why is the sky blue? Why do fish move faster in water than birds in air? Because water is heavier. But also then, how would you draw emotions on a face? How do the lips work to show emotion? All these things he's very observant and very curious about. And if we want to, every day, we can make ourselves at least 10% more observant and more curious about the world around us. We can pause for just a moment when we see a bird flying. And like Leonardo, we can say, does he flap the wings up faster or down faster? And what does that mean for how the bird flies? And I've been duck hunting in southern Louisiana. I know about the flight of ducks. But next time I go, I'm going to look at that wing and see exactly how the tips point and whether it goes up or down faster, because I want to be, just in the tiniest of ways, a little bit more like Leonardo.
I swear, Walter, when you talk about him, you still sound awed. It's lovely.
I mean, you know, look, I could be awed about Einstein, and certainly I'm impressed by Steve Jobs, and I love Benjamin Franklin. But you said at the beginning of this show something totally correct, which is, this is the pinnacle. It's the culmination of all I've written about.
Well, and you did a great job, you know. So.
Oh, Susan. I will say, I'm not sure I did a great job, but the pictures are wonderful.
All right. So tell me about your own next chapter, about teaching at Tulane.
I'm coming back to New Orleans I'm back in New Orleans now. We live on Royal and Dumaine, and my family home on Napoleon Avenue. My family's lived there since my great-granduncle, and my brother Neil lives there. Mm-hmm. So it's really good to be back home. I think every now and then people like myself get the opportunity to go to Time Magazine or Washington or whatever. But you got to remember your community and where you're from. And the chance to come back home, I love Tulane. I think teaching the history of science and the history of technology, which is what I will be doing at Tulane, is so important, because New Orleans and Tulane's future depends on connecting technology to creativity. That's going to be the strength of New Orleans. Not that we'll have more engineers, but we'll have more creative people who understand how technology and science work. So I'm going to teach the history of technology from the birth of the computer to social networks, starting in January at Tulane. And, you know, there's no place I love more than New Orleans, and Tulane is part of the soul of New Orleans.
Amen. Amen to that. We've been talking with Walter Isaacson, who is soon to take up a new position at Tulane, about his fascinating new biography, Leonardo da Vinci. You can meet him Wednesday, November 20th at 6 at Newman School in the auditorium there, or Thursday, November 21st at 6 at the New Orleans Jewish Community Center. Walter, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. It's always great to talk to you. Thank you.
As the year wears on, losses mount, of course, and we're heading into that time of year when we reckon those who've left us. I'd like to say a few words about the recent departure of Michael Murphy, whom I knew for almost 31 years. We first met at an American Booksellers Association meeting in Anaheim, California, in 1987. He was serving as indie liaison for Doubleday. He hosted a dinner before a concert by David Crosby, whose long time gone, The Autobiography of David Crosby, was projected to be a big title for Doubleday that fall. Dinner wore on, we talked about books and bookstores and the state of publishing, dire then, as always, changing then, as always, and we almost missed the concert. But being with Michael, whether you were talking or eating or listening, was always fun. And even then, he loved New Orleans and was determined to get here. And of course, when you got to know Michael, you got to know Marnie, and then you got to know his daughter Ella, and eventually his son Austin Murphy Park, and daughter-in-law Jacy, and granddaughter Cadence, and they got to know your family. And then there were Mardi Gras parties and all those good things about living in New Orleans, where Michael and family finally came for good in 2009. No one ever wanted to be a New Orleanian more than Michael Murphy. His first trip here was in 1983 when he came to work on promoting Anne Rice. He'd been publisher at William Morrow, a vice president of Random House in Putnam. He founded his own literary agency, Max & Company, and when he took on a writer, he took them on with passion and loyalty. And then a funny thing happened. The muse spoke to him just as she had been speaking all along, and Michael finally got to be a writer himself, and a damn good and funny one. In this, as in all things, he was driven by love. He wrote Hear Dat New Orleans, Eat Dat New Orleans, Fear Dat New Orleans, and now for the tricentennial, All Dat New Orleans, with the rich subtitle of eating, drinking, listening to music, exploring, and celebrating in the Crescent City. It's as quirky and wonderful a love letter to this place as we will ever have. He loved food, he loved music, he loved the offbeat and wonderful things about our city, and New Orleans loved him back. He died October 19th after a heart attack at the age of 63. Maybe that big heart of his was just full to the brim. He will be missed by all who love books and good times and great laughs and big hugs and stories. Michael, thanks for all the great times you and your family shared with mine, especially the Halloween night you showed up as a ghastly waiter at Goulatoire's. Now that's real New Orleans creativity on the doorstep. So remember this fine man, if you will, and read his books, and have a good laugh, and then go out and see New Orleans through his eyes, with the love of a writer who found his muse right where he knew she would be all along. Marnie had some words of wisdom of her own to offer. No one would have loved to die in New Orleans more than Michael Murphy. Amen and true dat. Miss you, old friend, and thanks. There will be an open house get-together to celebrate Michael's life Saturday, November 18th, from 3 to 7 at his home, 2860 Maurepas in New Orleans. RSVP by Thursday, November 16th, to the Facebook link on his page to attend. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. ESPN ex-game skater turned philosopher Nick Riggle discusses his book, On Being Awesome, A Unified Theory of How Not to Suck, Wednesday, November 15th at 6 at Octavia Books. It's fiction night at the Blood Jet Reading Series with Ambada Kazi Nance and Jessica Kinnison reading their work, Wednesday, November 15th at 8 at BJ's in the Bywater. Fans of Louis Maestro's wonderful novel, The Sound of Building Coffins, will have a chance to see chapters of it come to life in a dramatic adaptation called Glissaia Blues. It premieres at Infringe Fest New Orleans, playing at the Valiant Theater in Araby, Wednesday, November 15th at 7, Saturday, November 18th at 7, and Sunday, November 19th at 3. Tickets at infringe@valiant.brownpapertickets.com. Scott A. Greenberger discusses and signs The Unexpected President, The Life and Times of Chester A. Arthur, Thursday, November 16th at 6 at Octavia Books. D.A. Fields signs his new novel, Blood Memory Society, Thursday, November 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Room 220 presents poet and novelist Eileen Miles, reading from Afterglow, a memoir, Thursday, November 16th at 7 at the Saturn Bar. Mark Halpern discusses Insolence Paris in the present tense, Friday, November 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. Isabella Allende discusses her book, In the Midst of Winter, with Anne Gislason, Friday, November 17th at 7 at the Academy of the Sacred Heart, NIMS Fine Arts Center. This is a ticketed event. Go to Garden District Bookshop for more information. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses Commonwealth by Anne Patchett, Saturday, November 18th at 10:30 a.m. at Octavia Books. Donna Brazile discusses and signs her big new book, Hacks, the inside story of the break-ins and breakdowns that put Donald Trump in the White House, Saturday, November 18th from 5:30 to 7 at Garden District Bookshop. Anne Goethe discusses and signs her novel, Goner, Saturday, November 18th at 6 at Octavia Books. The National World War II Museum presents the 10th Annual International Conference on World War II, November 16th through 18th at the museum, with 3 full days of internationally known writers such as Rick Atkinson, Richard J. Evans, Nigel Hamilton, James Horn Fisher, Richard Overy, Robert Citino, and James Hamilton. Thursday, November 16th will be a day-long symposium devoted to Hitler scholarship. For more information, go to www.2conference.com. Today's guest, Walter Isaacson, discusses and signs Leonardo da Vinci. Monday, November 20th at 7 at the Newman School Henson Auditorium, presented by Garden District Bookshop. Tuesday, November 21st at 7 at the Uptown Jewish Community Center, presented by Octavia Books. Thursday, December 7th from 4 to 6, high tea and cocktails at Words and Music at the Hotel Monteleon. Tickets at falkhouse@aol.com. He also appears Monday, December 11th at 6:30 at the New Orleans Advocate. The Fantasy Book Club meets on the third Monday of the month at 6 at Tubby & Coo's Mid-City Bookshop. The November selection is Winter Song by S.J. Jones. And if it's November, it's National Novel Writing Month, which sets writers on the path of writing a 50,000-word novel by November 30th. The Lakeshore Branch Library, 1000 West Esplanade, hosts writing sessions from 5 to 8:30 every Monday in November. Shannon Kitchens facilitates. Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans, presented by the Pirate Sally Faulkner Society, is set for December 6th through 11th, with featured guests Walter Isaacson, John Gregory Brown and Carrie Brown, Andrew Burstein and Nancy Eisenberg, and Jeff Kleinman and Deborah Grosvenor. For more information and to register, check out wordsandmusic.org. Tubby & Coo's Mid-City Bookshop is partnering with local author Bill Lofelm to present 3 fiction writing workshops in November, the first 3 Saturdays from 2 to 4 at the bookshop. Classes are capped at 15 students for each day. Contact Bill Lofelm directly at nolabill@cox.net for registration and tuition info. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.